This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Chris Berrow, and at 5 GMT on Monday, the 22nd of September, these are our main stories. President Trump calls the murdered right-wing activist Charlie Kirk a modern-day martyr at his memorial service. Israel says there'll never be a Palestinian state, despite its recognition on Sunday by four Western countries. South Korea's president says that the North could temporarily keep its existing nuclear weapons as part of a deal. Also in this podcast...
We fled on foot with our children. The shelling was random. There are even children who fled and we still haven't found them. They fled into the wilderness.
The BBC gains rare access to war-torn Sudan. We begin in the United States, where the murdered right-wing activist Charlie Kirk has been hailed as a MAGA, or Make America Great Again, warrior at his memorial service in Arizona. President Trump was at the event in State Farm Stadium in Glendale, which was packed to capacity with 63,000 of his supporters for what's been described as part memorial, part political rally, part what they call a prayer breakfast. There are a succession of tributes to the 31-year-old who was shot dead at a university in Utah nearly 2 weeks ago. After the vice president, J.D. Vance, spoke, Mr. Kirk's widow, Erica, took to the stage.
After Charlie's assassination, we didn't see violence. We didn't see rioting. We didn't see revolution. Instead, we saw what my husband always prayed he would see in this country. We saw revival.
And she said this about her husband's assassin.
On the cross, our Savior said, Father, forgive them, for they not know what they do. That man, that young man, I forgive him.
During President Trump's tribute to Charlie Kirk, he credited him for helping him win last year's election.
Charlie didn't just bring young people into the movement. All of a sudden, it started to grow by leaps and bounds. By 2024, we won more young people than any Republican candidate in the history of our country, including, for the first time, a majority of males under 30. Can you believe it? We had a country that was dead 1 year ago, and now we have the hottest country anywhere in the world. And Charlie helped us make it that.
Our correspondent Arunade Mukherjee was in Glendale, and he told us what was significant for him.
Well, I think the biggest moment came when Erica Kirk was speaking, and you played out a bit of that as well. It was a mixture of her attempts at ensuring that Charlie Kirk's message continues to ring loud even after his death. But I think the biggest moment for the crowd was the time when she spoke about forgiving Charlie Kirk's killer. Quoting from the scriptures, she made that comment, and I think that's what drew a very loud, thunderous applause for quite a long time. And that's what we saw in glimpses from a lot of the people who spoke today. There was a mixture of political statements, statements which were referencing the Bible, and just talking about celebrating Charlie Kirk's life and legacy, really, of what he stood for, and most importantly, how he furthered conservative ideals. And I think the other aspect, which was very important, something that we've been mentioning, is just the sheer presence of the number of people who had gathered, tens of thousands, something that I can vouch for as I was standing here looking at the line trying to get into that stadium, and also the presence of the senior most members of Donald Trump's administration who had gathered here, spoke one by one, heaping praise on Charlie Kirk, and also very clearly, as you also just played out, Donald Trump's statement crediting him for their political fortunes last year.
Yeah, Donald Trump came on to speak after Erica Kirk, and I think he spoke for roughly an hour. It was quite a long speech. It did seem to touch on a lot of different topics. He definitely brought his policies into play. It's interesting that she mentioned forgiveness, but that when he was talking about Charlie Kirk's killer, he said, I hope he gets the death penalty. So there is a kind of, I don't know, he's very much pushing for that, isn't he?
Absolutely, and I think he was the first person soon after his death when he made that address on social media. He said and blamed the radical left. He said the radical left is responsible. We've heard other leaders of the administration also do the same. And I think he's been very clear about this. And in that same address, which you were referring to, it was interesting because he said, Erica, you might be able to do this, but he hates his detractors is what his message was, really. And he made that very clear that while we're talking about forgiveness and compassion, I think his message was very clear that those who are responsible for his killing, those who differ from their views, are people who politically they need to watch out for and, in a sense, politically crack down upon. And I think that is also a very significant political message that he is delivering. Like I said, this was a mixture of a lot of aspects, a lot of themes that really came together in what was, yes, a memorial service, but equally in many ways a political pitch, which is why you saw all these leaders very vehemently and aggressively talk about the need to carry this forward, saying that he was a martyr, he died doing God's work, he died doing what he loved, talking about the need for his ideals to stay in American political discourse and why it's important to keep that alive, even though Charlie Kirk is no more.
Arunade Mukherjee. The UK has joined Canada, Australia and now Portugal in formally recognising a Palestinian state. The declaration is aimed at reviving hopes of what's known as the two-state solution to end the long-running conflict between the Israelis and Palestinians. It comes just ahead of the second anniversary of the 7th of October attacks by Hamas, which led to the war in Gaza. The British Prime Minister Keir Starmer made the announcement in a recorded statement which was broadcast on Sunday.
With the actions of Hamas, the Israeli government escalating the conflict, and settlement building being accelerated in the West Bank, the hope of a two-state solution is fading. But we cannot let that light go out. We recognise the State of Israel more than 75 years ago as a homeland for the Jewish people. Today, we join over 150 countries who recognise a Palestinian state also, that there can be a better future.
Mustafa Barghouti, the head of the Palestinian National Initiative, said the UK and its allies needed to go further.
These recognitions coming too late from some countries like Britain and Australia and Canada are happening because these countries finally saw that Israel is destroying the very last opportunity of two-state solution. These countries are responding to what Israel is doing and not the other way around. Now, if Israel proceeds, it has to be subjected to sanctions. It has to be isolated, as it is now becoming isolated with the United States if it continues to support Israel. But eventually, we will win. Eventually, we will get our freedom.
So can this move revive hopes of peace? My colleague Oliver Conway asked our political correspondent in London, Rob Watson.
It does look massively unlikely at the moment for at least three fairly obvious reasons. Number one, the current Israeli government is against a two-state solution. Hamas was founded in the late 1980s because it opposes the whole idea of land for peace and recognising Israel and a two-state solution. Second, there's actually very little popular support among Israelis and Palestinians for a two-state solution. And then thirdly, and this I guess is the big one, all the polling and surveys suggest more generally that both Palestinians and Israelis, Oliver, see themselves as victims of the other side's inhumanity and have virtually zero trust in the other side. And so if you consider all of those things, it is an uphill struggle, to put it mildly.
So does this recognition by the UK, Canada and Australia, does it make any practical difference?
It doesn't make much practical difference. Let's take the UK, for example, and some of the others. It would mean upgrading Palestinian missions in their countries to being embassies. It would, for example, mean recognising Palestinian passports, although it wouldn't necessarily make it any easier for Palestinians to travel. They would still need visas. But I guess what they're hoping for is a symbolic gesture, and that is to let the world know, to let those in the region know that Israel's allies in the West are fed up with the fighting and want it to end. In no small part, of course, Oliver, because this conflict is stirring up terrible tensions in communities and the streets of the UK and other Western countries. So it's very much driven by domestic concerns too.
Now, this move has been signalled for some time and supporters of Israel have criticised it, but Keir Starmer confirmed plans to increase sanctions on Hamas. What more do we know about that?
We don't know yet. He said that that's a work in progress, but I think one has to see that as an attempt to assuage the critics who think this move, even if it's not meant that way, is something of a reward for terrorism, as they would see it, for the October the 7th attack. So I think it's partly to placate the United States, which is not happy about this move, but also to continue to insist that, look, the UK and others don't see that somehow calling for a Palestinian state means that they support any role for Hamas, although exactly how they would prevent that, they haven't made clear.
Well, the British Foreign Office website now refers to Palestine instead of the occupied Palestinian territories. Israel said that it rejected what it called a one-sided declaration of recognition. Here's the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu.
I have a clear message for those leaders who recognise a Palestinian state after the horrific massacre on October 7th. You are giving a huge reward to terrorism. And I have another message for you. It will not happen. A Palestinian state will not be established west of the Jordan River. For years, I have prevented the establishment of this terrorist state despite tremendous pressure both domestically and internationally.
France is expected to follow the UK and others by recognising a Palestinian state at the United Nations on Monday. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, John Sudworth, has more on Israel's reaction.
These announcements from the UK, more will follow, have been trailed in advance, and Israel has been making it very clear that it doesn't just think that this is an unhelpful move, it thinks, as you've been saying, that this is a reward for terrorism and an organisation with which it is still engaged in a bitter war. Interesting to hear the Israeli Prime Minister celebrating the fact that he himself personally has done more than many to prevent the possibility of a Palestinian state from being enacted. In that same video statement, pretty short statement, he said that he was proud to have doubled Jewish settlement in the West Bank during his time in office. And I suppose that tells us something kind of important here in terms of what the consequences of the recognition might be. You know, we heard Keir Starmer saying that his hope is that it would breathe some life back into that already very dim hope of the possibility. Of course, some people will fear that, in fact, it could do the opposite. It could act as a pretext for Israel to double down, possibly even to formally announce sovereignty over large swathes of the West Bank, a formal annexation, if you like, and actually snuff those hopes out once and for all.
Yeah, and we've already heard calls for that to happen imminently. What is the Israeli view in the population to that kind of call?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, there's a temptation, I think, for critics of Israel to see in these statements of defiance an ultra-nationalist government railing against, you know, international opinion. But on this issue, Benjamin Netanyahu is not an outlier. His comments have been echoed by the leader of the opposition in Israel, Yair Lapid, who has said that he thinks this is a mistake. And this is a man who, in principle, has in the past spoken in favour of the idea, at least, of a two-state solution. He called it today a one-sided recognition of a Palestinian state is a diplomatic disaster. It's a bad step. And he repeated those words. It's a reward for terror. But these are views that are shared across large swathes of the population. The families of the hostages still being held in Gaza say that this move will complicate their efforts to get their loved ones released. And if you look at the polling, opinion has only hardened since the beginning of the war, even on sort of fairly broad questions about the possibility of peaceful coexistence. The support for that amongst ordinary Israelis is now at historically low levels.
John Sudworth speaking to Oliver Conway. South Korea's president has told the BBC that he would accept a deal under which North Korea would be able to temporarily keep its existing nuclear weapons. Lee Jae-myung said this would be an emergency interim measure with denuclearisation the end goal. He wants President Trump to restart nuclear talks with the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Mr. Lee, in his interview with our Seoul correspondent Jean McKenzie, also said that he was shocked by the recent detention in the United States of hundreds of South Korean workers following an immigration raid at a Hyundai factory. But first, the issue of nuclear weapons.
Ideally, we want North Korea to denuclearize. But realistically, it won't be easy. Even now, it's adding 15 to 20 nuclear weapons a year. So the question is whether we persist with fruitless attempts to achieve our ultimate goal of denuclearization, or we set more realistic goals.
So would you therefore accept a deal between Trump and Kim that saw North Korea freeze its nuclear weapons program for now, with no future promises of denuclearization at this point?
If this were presented as the final deal, it would be difficult to agree to. But as an emergency, interim measure, yes, I can agree to that.
We saw China's military parade earlier this month, Xi Jinping welcoming Kim Jong-un alongside Vladimir Putin. No mention, no criticism of North Korea's nuclear weapons. What did you make of this?
Seeing China, Russia, and North Korea becoming so close is clearly not desirable for us. The world is increasingly dividing into two camps, and South Korea is positioned right on the border. But these camps cannot completely shut their doors, so we can position ourselves in the middle.
But do you think China is enabling North Korea's nuclear weapons program?
It's impossible to know, but no, that's not our understanding.
You've stopped radio broadcasts into North Korea. These were one of the very few ways that North Koreans could get information from outside the country. How do you justify turning these off at a time when the UN has just found that North Koreans are more isolated than they've ever been?
We don't think these broadcasts are very effective, and the cost is high because they tend to increase North Korea's hostility towards us.
But actually, the last time the North and South spoke in 2018, these broadcasts were ongoing, so we know that they're not an obstacle to diplomacy.
What happened in the past isn't relevant now. What matters is restoring trust between the North and South, especially since the last government stance toward North Korea was so hostile. We think these measures will help North Korea return to talks.
When you saw the Korean workers handcuffed and chained up in the U.S., just weeks after you had agreed to invest billions of dollars there, did you feel betrayed, like so many people in this country now do?
As president, I feel a profound sense of responsibility for the harsh treatment of our people, who were detained without committing any serious crimes. It was a shocking incident, but there's a Korean proverb that says, after the rain, the ground hardens. So I think this could be a good opportunity to strengthen our relationship.
Has it changed anything for you? What happened?
It's likely our companies will be more hesitant to invest in the U.S. So it's difficult to say there's been no impact. It's my responsibility to manage this so it doesn't damage our relationship.
The South Korean President Lee Jae-myung. In the past few hours, state media in North Korea has said that Kim Jong-un was open to talks with the U.S. as long as there was no demands for denuclearization. Still to come in this podcast:
get more people out, viewing the shops, the area.
Gets people out and about, feeling relaxed and comfortable, don't have to worry about getting run over by a car.
So where are you going to put the buses and taxis now? So it's just going to block up another road somewhere else.
Could a traffic-free Oxford Street in London transform its fortunes? Fighting has been raging between the Sudanese army and RSF paramilitaries for more than 2 years. Now, an area called the Kordofan States, sandwiched between Sudan's capital Khartoum and the region of Darfur in the west, has become the new front line in the civil war. The BBC has managed to get rare access to South Kordofan, where civilians are paying a heavy price in the war. Kalkidan Yibeltal reports.
Hospitals in Kadugli, the capital of Sudan's South Kordofan state, are struggling. Medical supplies are scarce, disease outbreaks are frequent, and malnutrition levels are high. In July and August alone, more than 40 people died from malnutrition in the state, according to an independent doctors' association. And with war on the doorstep, there are fears there will be many more. Nafisa, who is 21, says finding something to eat has been difficult for months.
I have three children, one at home and twins here in the hospital. They are sick and we have no money for food. I went to a village looking for food, but I found nothing. I came back and found them hungry and sick.
Kordofan became a major battleground after the army recaptured Khartoum in May. It wants to advance in the region and then push towards Darfur, a stronghold for the rival Rapid Support Forces, RSF. Movement within and out of South Kordofan is highly dangerous. And according to residents and aid agencies, the roads are blocked by RSF fighters and another rebel faction based in the nearby Nuba Mountains. Mahjoub Siraj Ali is the head of the state's Health and Development Office.
We have a complete cutoff, a scarcity and absence of some medicines, medicines for chronic diseases, hypertension and diabetes, medicines for tuberculosis, AIDS, malaria.
In late August, the UN's Children's Agency delivered the first humanitarian aid in 10 months to the state. It was desperately needed, but barely sufficient. The state is home to tens of thousands of people facing hunger. Khadija Abdurrahim fled her farming village due to the ongoing violence.
We fled on foot with our children. The shelling was random. There are even children who fled and we still haven't found them. They fled to other areas. They fled into the wilderness.
The UN said this war has created one of the worst humanitarian crises in the 21st century. And there are no signs of that coming to an end.
Calcidan Yabeltal. 3 years ago, Brazil's former president Jair Bolsonaro lost the election to Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. And earlier this month, he was sentenced to 27 years in prison for plotting a military coup in the aftermath of that election in order to remain in office. But in the last few days, the lower house of parliament passed a constitutional amendment that would make it harder to arrest or launch criminal proceedings against politicians. That's heading to the Senate. Then a bill was fast-tracked that could grant the former president and his allies amnesty. On Sunday, demonstrations took place across the country against the bills. No to amnesty, cried the protesters. Gabriela Sapessoa, a journalist with the Associated Press, is in Sao Paulo.
Nationwide protests. We had people filling the streets in all 26 states in the country and the federal district. It's huge, massive. Like, imagine Brazil is a continental country, you know. We don't have estimates for all the cities, but in Sao Paulo, where I am, researchers from the University of Sao Paulo estimated 42,000 people here and another 41,000 in Rio de Janeiro. Over 80,000 people in both cities.
Why is the sense of feeling so strong amongst the protesters to get out in such large numbers?
I think that the organizations that called the protests, they could unite people that were indignated for this bill proposal that generated like a lot of anger in Brazil. And another project that was also fast-tracked in Congress. I believe that the way that it moved so fast and so easily in Congress made people want to react, like stand against it.
One of the bills has the potential to grant the former president amnesty along with some of his allies over this coup. Why do you think it is that it got past this early stage, the early stage of the bill getting through? Does that mean that the current president, Lula da Silva, has quite a weak grip on power for it to even get as far as this?
That's right, Chris. He has problems building a solid coalition in Congress. And because the Congress, it has a right-wing or center-right majority, the opposition has largest numbers in Congress than Lula's coalition, right? So they are more aligned with the right, and Lula doesn't have a grip on them.
Donald Trump announced a little while ago a 50% tariffs on Brazilian imports, and he said that this was a witch hunt against Jair Bolsonaro. Has his intervention played a part in getting these bills past these first hurdles as well, or do people not really mind about the Donald Trump factor?
Of course, those who are Bolsonaro supporters, his allies in Congress and in the Senate, they are really happy about Trump's support. But the thing is, it's very, very unlikely that this will go forward first, because the president of the Senate said he's against it. Senior senators also said they're against it, and it's highly unpopular here. I saw this on the streets today. People were carrying signs saying, Brazil is a sovereign country, Trump, stay out of Brazil.
Gabriela Sapessoa. China's property sector once made up a third of the country's GDP, but over the last 5 years, that boom has turned to bust. The largest companies are being taken to court and dismantled, and property bought by ordinary citizens has plummeted in value. Matt Lines has been looking at what went wrong.
The world's most indebted property developer, Evergrande, has been given a winding-up order by a court in Hong Kong.
Let's talk a little bit more about Evergrande. The liquidators are preparing to focus now on the company's founder, Hui Kaiyan.
The last few years have seen headlines like these coming out of China regularly. News of some of the country's biggest property companies defaulting, putting out profit warnings, and delisting from the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. So how did we get here?
The property market, first of all, was such an important part of the economy. It accounted for 30% of GDP at the peak. It was also the one place where everybody put their money.
That's Alexandra Stevenson, Shanghai Bureau Chief for the New York Times.
When Xi Jinping came into power 6-7 years into his presidency, he started talking about this idea that homes were not for speculating, they were for living in. And then in August of 2021, Evergrande, which was one of the biggest property developers in China, issues this profit warning. You know, everybody starts thinking, oh my God, this is China's Lehman moment. And then in December of 2021, Evergrande defaults. Country Garden was another giant in the property market. In 2023, Country Garden had its own problems. And so another moment in the property sort of bust, where there was another realization that we hadn't reached the bottom and that there was more to come.
In 2022, the BBC's China correspondent Stephen McDonnell met some of those who'd stopped paying their mortgages on their unfinished apartments. He asked one of them how many people were living in the building he visited.
100 or 200? We used up all our savings to buy our apartments. It's been 5 years and we can't live in them. We can't bear it any longer. We're out of options. It's hard to make money, but there are still house and car repayments.
At its height in 2017, Evergrande was worth $50 billion and now, 8 years later, has been removed from the Hong Kong Stock Exchange and put into liquidation. It had been valued at just over $260 million, with shares worth 2 cents when a trading freeze was imposed on the country in January of last year. Desmond Shum is a Chinese property tycoon and multimillionaire who's been in the industry for decades and once moved in the highest echelons of power in Beijing.
One of the vice minister of land development, and he made a statement 2 years ago, and he said, we have built enough housing for 3 billion people to live in. And China, as we know, has 1.4 billion.
So why is this bubble played out differently, seemingly, to other bubbles, say, in the US and other countries around the world, where you see companies collapse? Why is it playing out over such a long period of time?
The government have tremendous control on every aspect of the society and the economy. That means the insolvent developers in, you know, any other country, those companies will have bankrupt and bailed up years ago, right? The debt owners or the creditor of the bank will have go after the assets of the company and try to recuperate their investment. But in China, you are not allowed to do it. So they only will belly up at the timing of government's choosing. And their creditors can't even go after the assets of the companies.
The crisis has hit a number of sectors across China, with the real estate industry a big major source of revenue for local governments. There's also been hits to the construction industry, a huge employer. And for ordinary people who put their savings into property that's not worth anywhere near what they paid for it. The effects won't just be felt within China. Alicia Garcia Herrero is chief economist for the Asia-Pacific region at financial services firm Natixis.
What it means for all of us outside of China is that China will do its utmost, more than ever, to conquer markets, whether it's through exports to us, us consuming Chinese goods more than ever. So the presence of China will not be reduced because of real estate sector crisis. On the other way around, it will be larger than ever in the manufacturing sector.
That report was from Matt Lines. Oxford Street has hundreds of thousands of visitors every day, and it's just 300 metres from the BBC's headquarters here in central London. On Sunday, as part of efforts to try to encourage more people to visit, it went traffic-free. London's Mayor Sadiq Khan wants to pedestrianise the key thoroughfare, but his plan is controversial. David Lewis took a short walk to find out more.
I'm standing here in the middle of Oxford Street, and I have to say, recording this piece is one of the most bizarre experiences. Normally, this stretch of tarmac that cuts through the West End is chock-a-block with red double-decker buses, black taxis, cars honking, loads of noise, and today that's been replaced with pop-up food stalls. I can see a basketball court, there's a wellness area, there's two art exhibitions apparently, and it's all part of the London Mayor's office to try and pedestrianise this street, Europe's busiest shopping street. It's not just cars and buses that have been banned, bikes are not allowed, and e-scooters too, but in true London fashion, some people are ignoring it. There's a bike whizzing past me now, actually. So, what's it like for these people who are visiting?
I think it's a good idea. Why? I'm not sure. Get more people out, talking, seeing each other, viewing the shops, the area.
Gets people out and about, feeling relaxed and comfortable, don't have to worry about getting run over by a car. It's lovely.
But it wouldn't really be London if everyone agreed with each other, would it? Some people are quite critical of the idea of pedestrianising Oxford Street, especially black taxi drivers who will say this will be very tricky to reroute them around this very, very busy artery. Not everyone is on board.
You still need transport for buses and stuff. So where are you going to put the buses and taxis now? Shove them somewhere else. So it's just going to block up another road somewhere else.
So what next? Well, if it all goes to plan, London's Mayor office is saying they're hoping to start the pedestrianising process from as early as January next year.
David Lewis there. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you'd like to comment on the podcast and the topics we're covering, do send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at BBC World Service, and you can use the hashtag GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Zavihullah Karush. The producers were Daniel Mann and Anna Aslam. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Chris Barrow, and until next time, thanks for listening. Goodbye.